This is Nachyomi, Sefer Melachim Bet, Chapter 6. Elisha's students find that their lodgings no longer provide sufficient living space for them. He instructs them to move to a new area and build a dwelling for themselves. One of them insists that he, the prophet, accompany them, and he agrees. While they're cutting down trees, the axe head of one of the disciples falls into the Jordan River and disappears. He is very distraught because he has borrowed it from someone else. Elisha throws a stick into the water, and the axe head floats to the top, at which time he tells the student to retrieve it. The king of Aram is continually attempting to attack Israel, but his designs are thwarted because every time he makes a plan, Elisha informs the king of Israel of those plans in advance, and he's able to avoid being caught. The king of Aram decides to focus on apprehending and killing Elisha, so the king of Israel loses his greatest defensive asset. Elisha and his servant wake up in the morning in Dotan to discover a vast array of chariots and soldiers from Aram encamped around the city to seize them. And the servant is afraid. Elisha reassures his attendant that they have a greater army on their side than does Aram, and prays to Hashem to open the young boy's eyes so he too can perceive the heavenly horses and chariots of fire that encircle Elisha like a protective wall. When the troops of Aram descend to arrest Elisha, he prays to Hashem to strike them with blindness and then convinces them that they've come to the wrong address. They've got the wrong guy. The prophet offers to guide them to the right place, but he guides them to Shomeron, where he stands them before the king of Israel, and then restores their vision. The king of Israel, seeing the enemy forces vulnerable and within his grasp, asks Elisha if he should strike them down. Elisha responds that they should be treated not as combatants, but as captives, and therefore should be provided with food and drink. The men of Aram partake of bread and water offered to them in Shomron, and then return to their country. The border incursions from Aram cease from this point on. Ben-Hadad lays siege to Shomron for 3 years, and there is a severe and crippling famine in Israel. Ben-Hadad, of course, is the king of Aram. Even normally inedible items like donkeys' heads and dung are exorbitantly priced because they are the only sustenance the population has available. One day, the king of Israel is walking along the wall of the city when a woman calls to him for help. At first, he dismisses her plea, saying, "How can I help you? Only Hashem can help you. I'm not in a position to do anything." But then he invites her to share her story. The woman tells a terrible story about she and her neighbor had entered into a kind of deal that they would kill their children. Each of them had a son. They would kill their children and share them as meals. The problem was that this woman had killed her son, and they had already eaten him. But now the other woman, the neighbor, refused to honor her side of the bargain. She wouldn't carry through with her side of the deal, and therefore refused to give over her son. So the king is so terrified and moved by the depths of depravity to which suffering has brought the people that he tears his garment and shows that there's actually sackcloth underneath. He's been wearing sackcloth, which means he's been praying and repenting, hoping for God to improve the situation. Of course, there's nothing he can do to help the woman with her plight, but it highlights the severity of the circumstances. The king's moment of sadness quickly translates into anger. He declares his intention to execute Elisha the prophet for having allowed this ordeal to befall the people, and he sends a messenger to seize the prophet. Meanwhile, Elisha is sitting and conversing in his house with the elders of Israel when he receives a prophetic message that, in his words, this son of a murderer, meaning the son of Ahab, Yehoram, has come to kill him. A messenger will soon arrive with the king not far behind him. Elisha instructs the elders to shut the door and keep it closed. When the messenger finally does arrive, followed by the king, who speaks to Elisha, apparently, at least in the beginning, it's from behind the door, and he bemoans the evil that has been visited upon Israel and asks how much longer the Jewish people must wait for deliverance from Hashem. There's a great deal to comment on in this chapter. We don't get to hear Elisha's answer until the next chapter. Let us highlight just a few of the interesting elements here. The rabbis observe that it's only after the removal of Gehazi from his job as attendant to Elisha that all of a sudden there are too many disciples and they can't fit in their accommodations anymore. Apparently, Gehazi's negative influence and maybe his policies of exclusion prevented those who sought to learn from Elisha from gaining access to him. The absence of Gehazi allows for positive change of dynamic in the academy of Elisha. The whole episode, though, reveals to us how fundamentally different, really, Elisha is from his teacher Eliyahu. Eliyahu was a loner. He spent most of his time in solitude. The majority of his interactions with others are prompted by necessity. Elisha, by contrast, is intimately involved with other people. He lives with his students, eats with them, and builds houses with them. As we've seen from the very outset, Elisha's conception of the role of the prophet is of a teacher and mentor who lives among the people, shares their burdens, and advocates for their welfare. The story of the army of Aram also emphasizes this quality of Elisha. He serves as an asset to the king of Israel, providing him with inside intelligence that safeguards and promotes the interests of Israel. When the troops descend upon Elisha, he allows his worried attendant to perceive the chariots and horses of fire that surround and protect them. Undoubtedly, these chariots of fire are the same that Elisha saw carry Eliyahu away to heaven, and then inspired him to refer to Eliyahu himself as the chariot of Israel. Elisha called Eliyahu the chariot of Israel because, like a military chariot that on a physical level provides safety and security to its nation, Eliyahu protected the nation of Israel through spiritual strength in the merit of his relationship with Hashem. Elisha, who one day will also be dubbed chariot of Israel when he passes away, enables his servant to see that he too is a vehicle of divine providence and protection for Israel, and that they have nothing to fear from the threat looming over them. However, perhaps unlike Eliyahu, Elisha seems to embrace his role in a more positive spirit than did his mentor. Just as Elisha endows his attendant with special vision so that he can perceive the invisible, spiritual activity occurring behind the scenes, so too does he ask Hashem to remove vision from the army of Aram that attempts to besiege him. Many of the commentaries explain that this is not so much a physiological blindness, but a state of confusion that descended upon them and confounded them. That's actually even what Rashi says. When he's finally guided them to Shomron, their clarity of perception returns, and they must have rightfully feared for their lives. Rather than allow the king of Israel to take advantage of the vulnerability of his enemies, though, Elisha tells him to follow the path of compassion and mercy, offering them food and drink, and then send them home. Just as with the healing of Naaman, Elisha places the highest value on the sanctification of Hashem's name through manifesting his infinite kindness to all of his creatures. And indeed, this approach was successful in fostering a state of peace and tranquility between Aram and Israel, at least for some time afterward. There's much discussion in the modern commentaries about the identity of the king of Israel, who is never named, in this story, since the one that follows seems clearly to refer to Yehoram, son of Ahav. Many contemporary writers find it difficult to accept that the wicked Yehoram would show such deference to Elisha, calling him Avi, my father, and heeding his instructions so carefully when given the opportunity to strike the army of Aram. For this and several other reasons, they suggest that this episode took place maybe later, during the period of one of the kings that enjoyed a closer and more cooperative relationship with Elisha, and that it's included here out of chronological order because it fits into the theme of this catalog of the deeds of Elisha. Proponents of this view offer a number of persuasive arguments to support it. Nevertheless, we will follow the opinion of our traditional sages that these stories all describe Yehoram, son of Ahav. Across his career, we see that he had a complicated and ambivalent attitude toward Elisha, sometimes ignoring him, sometimes seeking him, sometimes rejecting him. And in all the stories about him, whether he is named or not, he has a signature style of operation. He tends to react first and only think second. For example, when he's contacted by the king of Aram about Naaman's illness, his first response is to panic and fret, and he's not able to regain his composure until Elisha reaches out to him. Similarly, when the army of Aram arrives in Shomron, his initial thought is to kill them until Elisha steps in. We see this again when he runs to execute Elisha for his purported role in the famine, but then backtracks and humbly requests his guidance instead. This pattern of behavior strongly supports the traditional view that the king of Israel in all three stories is Yehoram, who, like his father Ahav, was a complicated personality. Indeed, we can see why he is regarded as a substantial improvement over his father in terms of his principles, policies, and relationship with Hashem. Then again, it seems that Elisha's influence had much to do with that as well. It's quite conceivable that when Elisha brought nothing but blessings to the king, he was willing to heed his directives, and that when famine decimated the population, the king held Elisha responsible and vented anger toward him. In this way, the appellation "my father" is quite apt. Elisha was a sort of father figure to the people and to the king, dealing kindly and generously with them, helping them, yet never compromising or apologizing for the high moral standards by which Hashem judged and punished them. In the story of the famine itself, we see the inner conflict of the king as well. Distraught over the suffering of his nation, he's been wearing sackcloth and probably praying and fasting, hoping for deliverance from God. This reflects positively on his capacity for self-reflection and introspection. He takes responsibility for the situation and recognizes its divine origin. Yet when he is pushed over the edge by the tragic tale of the two desperate women plotting to consume their own children, he is filled with rage and blames the prophet for the terrible state of affairs. This shows us a side of his character that is less noble and more immature. However, despite the aggressive intentions he articulates, and Elisha's labeling him son of a murderer, when he reaches the prophet, we see, again, his humility and desperation, not violence. We will consider Elisha's response to Yehoram in the chapter ahead.